Welcome to Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor. Zorba here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, call us right now at 1-800-462-7413. And along with your calls, Zorba always has some interesting topics to talk about.
Right. We're going to talk about video games. You know, the new systems such as the Wii system, active games that actually promote physical activity, not the ones that just use the thumb or, we'll say, the old-fashioned pinball machines. We're going to talk about these video games, how they might fit in to sort of a healthy lifestyle. And then we're going to talk about radiation and the nuclear issues. We know what's going on in Japan. Well, people have questions about that radiation. We'll try to talk a bit about that and answer those questions.
Yeah, that's worth sticking around for, I think. What's our recipe?
Cod and lentils. You've heard of fish and chips. This is cod and lentils. It's a great healthy alternative to something that is fried and not really that healthy.
Okay, that's coming up. 800-462-7413. Don't forget about our medical myth buster later on. Right now, we welcome our first caller, Zorba, a listener with us in Blackfoot, Idaho. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. How can we help you?
Well, I've just been wondering, my husband has some red dots that he keeps getting around his eyes, kind of almost like an allergy. And we're trying to possibly go to, you know, like a dermatologist or something, but we kind of guessed that they would probably try to do the same thing as trying to deduce what it would be. So,
In other words, and we used to say one grandmother is worth two pediatricians because of the advice that is. And this is similar to that advice. I had a mentor, Bob Mendelson, and he said that.
Yeah.
So going back to these red dots, when did they start? They've been there for a long time or a short
period? About a year and a half.
Mm-hmm. Year and a half ago. Change in soap or anything that he's done? I mean, that's one of the things you look at. You look at soap, you know, any sort of cosmetics. Guys don't tend to put cosmetics on, but sometimes they actually, you know, put on aftershave lotion. Has that changed at all? You don't work
alone? No, it hasn't. One of the only things that we've kind of been able to think that it might be is we heard about, like, a possible allergic reaction that some people get to, like, sulfates, like sodium lauryl sulfate and ammonium lauryl sulfate.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And so we've kind of tried to get rid of, like, all of that, but there's really... It's in everything.
Right.
So.
Those are things that are stabilizers. Whatever they are, sodium lauryl sulfate kind of sounds like it would be pretty because it's got the word laurel in it. But the reality is it's a chemical.
Yeah.
But that's a good idea. Always good to remove cosmetics and chemicals and soaps to see if that's it. Acne? Does he have acne at all?
No, he doesn't.
No. And what have you tried? Have you tried over-the-counter hydrocortisone, anything of that nature?
We did. We tried that for quite a while, mm-hmm. and that sort of worked. And then he did end up going to a doctor, and the doctor prescribed a steroid cream.
Okay.
But I guess it thins the skin, and it also, you know, it works while he's using it, but then the moment he stops using it, then it just kind of comes back in full force.
Oh. Got you. Okay, so anti-inflammatories did work to keep it down, but then when he stops these steroid creams, then they come back.
Yeah.
You know, there are a couple of issues here. First of all, the question is, what is this? And sometimes you can get a different sort of a dermatitis, which just means an inflamed skin from a whole bunch of different things. Hit it with some steroid cream, it goes away. And for a lot of people, men and women, just kind of disappears, doesn't come back. And we never quite figure out what started it out. And he's had that as a trial. So I don't think you have a diagnosis of this. I mean, I think the idea of going to a dermatologist is a good idea. You know, he's gone, obviously, to his primary care doc, you know, and they haven't come up with the answer. Sometimes these are actually a variation of almost an infection that's there. And sometimes there's a drug called Metrogel, Metrogel. It's not a steroid. It's an antibiotic of sorts. It's not really an antibiotic, but it's kind of like an antibiotic that we put into a gel form. And sometimes people have something called rosacea, which is a different manifestation of problems in the face. And when we use this antibiotic gel, bang, it goes away. And it's been used for a variety of other things. It does not thin the skin. You did your homework. You looked on the web, and it, you know, you noticed that if you use steroids for long periods of time, it's really not good. There are also other anti-inflammatory things that you can use and try even before you go to the doctor. And one of the things I would try is I would go get some T-Gel, and I'll put the name of that on our website and on our Facebook page, a T-Gel shampoo. And what I would do is I just put it on. It's got tar in it. I'd put it on the top where it is, exactly where the bumps are. I'd let it sit for 5 or 10 minutes, then I'd wash it off. And I'd almost use it as if it were a cream or an ointment. In other words, it's in soap, but it's used for people who have recalcitrant dandruff and seborrheic dermatitis. And sometimes you just put it's got tar in it, and it's totally safe. Put it on, and sometimes that'll get rid of the inflammation, and that might save you a trip to the dermatologist. And again, once again, I'll put the link on our website and Facebook page.
That sounds good.
Okay, good luck to you. Let us know what happens.
All right, thank you very much.
We appreciate the call. Thank you. 1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number, 800-462-7413. Now to Logan, Utah. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
You bet. What's up?
I have a history of skin cancer in my extended family, and I remember as a kid my mom going in, and she always come back with 2 or 3 moles removed, it seems. So I have a few moles that my wife said need to be looked at, but I haven't wanted to go in for fear that I'd be told I had skin cancer, or quite frankly, for the financial responsibility of it. But recently I got insurance that pays for preventative visits like mole checks, that I quite honestly went in assuming that the money wouldn't even cover all the moles that they'd be removing. But actually, when I went in, they didn't remove any of them and didn't even seem too concerned about any of them. So my question is, has the mindset changed over the years? Or do I have a misconception of what makes a bad mole?
Oh, you don't have a misconception. Well, what makes a bad mole? There's some moles that are okay, but let's look back at a couple things. First of all, your mom. You want to know if your mom had melanoma, which is basically a skin cancer that looks like a mole. Can start in a mole or can start without a mole. So do you know if she had melanoma? The most common skin cancer is basal cell skin cancer. That comes from the sun. It does not spread. They're removed, and they're, you know, there's not really a hereditary issue there. There it's related more to the sun. So do you know what kind of skin cancer your mom had?
I think it was the basal cell one. I don't remember her being too concerned about it either. But
so you want to find that out. Your mom's still around, right?
Uh-huh.
So you want to call her up, say, Mom, what was your skin cancer? Did you have melanoma? The reason is this. Melanoma, for some people, is genetic. In other words, it can basically still be caused by the sun, but you can have a genetic predisposition to it. If your mom had melanoma, you're at a higher risk to have melanoma. You want to know that. So if she had basal cell, it's just related to the sun. Getting a check is very important, but that's a critical issue. That's number one. Number two, is there a change in the mindset? No, but not all moles are removed. In other words, a doctor who knows how to look at a mole can generally make a good guess, and that's what it is. It's a guess as to whether or not the mole is bad or not bad. So what are the things about it? And it's basically, you know, we used to call it, and we still call it ABCD. So D means diameter. How big is it? If it's bigger than the diameter, for instance, of a pencil eraser, then it's not good. A is the appearance. In other words, what is the appearance of the mole? Has it changed in appearance? Has it become funkier or different so that you say, hey, this thing is growing? B is the color. Is it black? And C means color. And because sometimes it can just have not a black color but a discolored. And if you go to our website or our Facebook page, we'll give you a link to the ABCDs because there's nothing like looking at this in pictures. And we'll give you a link for ABCD that'll connect to one of the dermatological sites. And that'll show you what you're looking for. So it really hasn't changed. We're very interested in moles that change and look bad. It's that we don't automatically remove a mole. Now, there is another issue here. Your wife. So she who must be obeyed, which is as we refer to wives in our house, or if mama ain't happy, ain't nobody
happy.
You
can get away with that in your house?
Actually, Penny likes it. I'll say she who must be obeyed. And you know what she goes? She goes, yes, that's exactly right. How about it? Obvious. And have you tried it in your house?
I'm not going to try.
But we know that that is correct. Monica, she who must be obeyed, as we say in our house. But I mean, if your wife goes, hey, you ought to check it out, I think that's important. And I'll tell you something. That's because guys tend not to check things out. And frankly, women are more likely to go into the doctor. So, I mean, money is an issue and it's a problem in our society. But fear that they're going to find something, you got to get that out of your brain and say, if I'm worried that I've got something, I'm going to go see the doctor. I want to set that off. That's something you ought to change. So you've got some homework. Number one, call your mom. Did she have melanoma or just basal cell? Number two, get rid of your fear. And number three, kiss your wife and say, thanks, honey, for making me see the doctor.
All right. Thank you very much.
You take care now.
Thank you for the call at 1-800-462-7413. So, Zorba, we're going to talk about video games.
Yeah, the new Wii game. You know what the Wii game is, don't you?
Not really.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, these things are incredibly popular, and they're more and more popular as time goes on. And they're different from the first, second, third, fourth, and fifth generation video games, which really use the thumbs and the wrist, things that, I've never had any interest at all. But the Wii games get your body moving.
Oh, these are the interactive games.
They're interactive games. Yeah. You're looking at a video screen. They're interactive. Yeah. You're moving.
You can play tennis or bowl.
Golf or a whole bunch of other things. Yeah. And the question all along has been, is this really fitness? I mean, is it really fitness or not fitness? And is it fitness for teenagers? And how good is this, for instance, for obese teenagers, which is, of course, a big issue. So what they did is they took teenage boys and girls and they put them on a treadmill and they compared them going on a treadmill versus doing games. And they looked at a variety of games, things like Sports Wall, the Jackie Chan Alley Run. You, of course, are familiar with that, right?
I do it all the time.
The Wii Golf, the Zavix, Light Space Bug Invasion. Now, I must admit, I've never heard of that. The Cybex Trailer Goalie Wars, Dance Revolution, that one I've actually heard of, and the Wii Boxing, Nintendo Wii Boxing, which I've actually seen. Which is sort of – and they looked at it. They compared it. Lo and behold, walking on a treadmill at 3 miles per hour, and that's not a fast walk. That's just walking, is 5 mets. A met is a metabolic equivalent of exercise that we in exercise physiology use. So 5 means kind of you're kind of walking down the street.
Yeah.
You know, when you're going at a full space and you're running full bore, that's 13 mets. Okay, so you've got 5 mets on one side, 13 mets on the other side. The Wii game Dance Revolution was 4 mets. In other words, it was more than walking. When you look at the Lightspace and the Zavix games, they were about 5 to 6 mets, and the Sports Wall was 7 mets.
Yeah.
Now, this is very, very interesting.
But one of the issues would be when you do a treadmill, you tend to do it 30, 40 minutes at a time.
Have you ever tried to get a teenager on a treadmill for 30
minutes?
No,
I'm just saying, these games, if the teen does these games for 5 minutes, it's not the same as a half an hour.
Well, it's very interesting. The more popular the game, basically, and the more competitive, the more interactive, and the more mets they actually got involved in. So in other words, you have full issues. If you make it competitive and interesting, they do it longer and more often.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if you're doing it for only 5 or 10 minutes, you're right. On the other hand, we know from an exercise point of view that 5 or 10 minutes twice during a daytime adds up to 20 minutes, and exercise is additive. We know that obese teens are obese because they're not doing much. I think these games are dynamite, and I think they ought to be rolled up by doctors, exercise physiologists, nurses, mothers and fathers, and say, this is a way to get your body going. You don't have to be outside. And frankly, in the wintertime, a lot of people in the north, they don't go outside.
Right.
You know, they stay inside. They don't want a snowshoe. They don't want to cross-country ski. But they're willing to pay the Wii games, and I think these are great.
They certainly beat the things that ruin your thumbs by just...
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when you look at it from a competitive point of view, getting your body going and making it interesting is the dynamite way to do it. And again, I think the prejudice against these games is similar to the prejudice against treadmills that probably came out when they came out. Anything that gets your body going... dynamite.
800-462-7413. And on we go to Jacksonville, Florida now. Hi.
Hey there.
How can we help?
Well, I've got a weird issue, really. I have a Zippo lighter, and I refilled it. This has happened 2 or 3 times now. Whenever I refill it, it kind of gets a little bit wet on the outside, not to the point where it feels wet, just a little bit greasy. I put it in my jean pocket, and after about 30 seconds to a minute of it being in my jean pocket, I start to get this, like, Zippo-shaped chemical burn on my leg.
Oh, wow.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Uh-huh. And it's horrible. It's this agonizing pain, and it stays there, the burn. I mean, I've still got one from, like, 3 weeks ago.
Ouch. Well, now, first, before Zorba helps you out, and I'm sure he will, you use this Zippo lighter only to light candles at romantic times, right? You certainly don't use the Zippo lighter for any other purpose.
No. That's absolutely right.
Okay. I'll tell you what I think is happening. But first of all, back in the day, when I was in college, I smoked cigarettes. I smoked for 3 years, saw the light many, many years ago, more than 30 years ago. Yeah. And I had Zippo lighters. I mean, it kind of brings back memories. When my dad died, I went down to the basement of my house. My dad used to smoke Philly Blunt cigars. They were just awful. Smoked in the house and out of the house. Yeah. And he had a whole box of Zippo lighters in the basement, these old Zippo lighters, which I have in my house as a memory. And I know what you're talking about because I remember filling the Zippo lighters, and it has a grease that's whatever in the lighter fluid that comes out. And, of course, it's aromatic. There's a smell to it because it's almost like it's a petroleum product, and it's almost kerosene. I'm not sure exactly what lighter fluid is. And what's happening is you're responding to that. In other words, there's something either in the perfume that's in the lighter fluid, and I believe they put a perfume in it. There's definitely a smell to it that I can remember. There's the oil and the grease that's basically in the outside of the lighter, and you are basically having a response to that. I mean, that's the long and the short of it. And you're having a dermatitis. And this burn that's going in there is the burn from the fumes because it's an active, it's an active thing. And I have a couple of suggestions. First of all, when it happens, you need to go initially and get an over-the-counter hydrocortisone cream. But often those are not strong enough. So if you call up or see your family doc, what you want is a stronger cream, either 2.5% hydrocortisone, or you want to go to even a stronger cream like triamcinolone cream, commonly called TMC cream. It's a moderate strength. Hydrocortisone type cream. It's not hydrocortisone, but it's a steroid cream. Works really well, and I give it to a lot of my patients. I say if you have a serious dermatitis, use it. Don't use it on the face, but it would be good on the leg, and you need that to get rid of it. But really what you want to do is basically if you're going to fill your Zippo lighter to use, of course, as Tom said, only for romantic candle lighting purposes, what you want to do is you want to wipe it off. Yeah. And one way to wipe it off very quickly, I mean, there are a few ways. You you don't want to put it under the sink, but you want to wipe it off with something that is probably going to take care of it. And I think if you used something like a Purell on the top of it, on the top of it, which is an alcohol-based product, which is probably not going to bother you, it's going to get rid of the petroleum-based product, and that's probably going to take care of it.
Yeah. Couldn't you just change lighters? There must be some that don't leak like Zippo's do.
Well, I really like it because my boyfriend got it all engraved and stuff. So,
So it's, you see, Tom was right. It's got a romantic aspect to your Zippo.
Right.
Tom has prescience. He is so intuitive. He just knew from the way you were talking. It's great. So that's what I do. You got to wipe it off, and I would use something like Purell to wipe it off.
I always say for romance, you can't beat a Zippo lighter. Ooh la la. Thanks, honey.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Well, before we step aside for a short break, Zorba, we have a note here from the Zorba Pastor on your Health Grammar Police Internal Affairs Unit acquitting you from a recent charge.
Oh, wow.
As you may recall, you were cited for pronouncing fillet in fish fillets as fillets when you should have been saying fillet. Well, our inbox quickly filled with folks stepping to your defense. Deputy Carroll captures the general theme, writing, "In my 1994 New Standard Edition of the HarperCollins Robert French English Dictionary, F-I-L-E-T and F-I-L-L-E-T are appropriately interchangeable. Sometimes the grammar police are impersonators. It may be best for the grammar police to acknowledge that language evolves. A contemporary English-speaking reader of Shakespeare finds his English to be odd, even unintelligible, because modern English has moved on. The English of George Eliot and American Civil War soldiers, so specific, so eloquent, is also history, unfortunately. It may be best to advise the grammar police to chill.
Kick back, grammar police. Kick back and relax, because the language changes.
So
I love it. I love it. They came to my defense and they acquitted me of my offense.
A fillet is a fillet is a fillet.
Thank you, Tom.
If you want to join the Zorba Pastor on your health grammar police or correct them, you can do so by sending an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have a fillet recipe coming up and more of your calls, too. So you're going to want to stick around here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Coming to you from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Glad to have you along. We hope you'll stay with us. More of your calls coming up at 1-800-462-7413. That's 800-462-7413. But before our next call, Zorba, our recipe for cod and lentils?
Cod lentils. Well, let's look at fish and chips. Do you like fish and chips?
No.
I do. No, well, that conversation is over.
Yeah.
I even love fish and chips. I like it. I like fish.
Well, the fish is fried. It's fried.
And it's tasty and it's good. But
isn't
we know it's bad for
us. Breaded too.
Sometimes it's breaded. Sometimes it's not breaded. Yeah. I mean, there are different ways of doing it and there are variety. But good fish and chips I like. But it's fried. It's oil. And fish is good. And the reality is a lot of people eat fish oil because it has DHA and EHA,
right,
which we know are important. And they think it's a substitute for fish. And it's not. We know from the Mediterranean diet and we know from good research that eating fish once or twice a week is good for us. Fish oil may be useful for, quote, lowering triglycerides, which is a number. But the fact is, it is not a substitute for fish.
Yeah. Aren't we digressing a little bit?
No, we're not. Okay. So you've got to find a better fish recipe. And you want to find one that is more heart healthy that you like.
Yeah.
Now, I happen to like beans. I happen to like lentils. It's very good. We're using cod in this recipe, but you can use any other white fish that you can find that's good. So you can use flounder. Mm-hmm. You can use tilapia. I think I'm pronouncing it correctly. I always pronounce it and mispronounce it. And I think it's tilapia.
I think that's right, too.
And tilapia is very, very good. I happen to like it. It happens to be a freshwater, more eco-friendly fish.
Mm-hmm.
There are issues with farm-raised salmon that do not occur with tilapia. It's more, as I said, more acceptable. But a white fish that may be used, it's simple and it's easy, and people should try it. Now, in my house, when we ate fish, it was smelt. Smelt is disgusting. Now, I mean, there are a lot of people that like smelt. Don't get me wrong. We're going to get the pro-smelt letters, but I think it's because my father would catch smelt. My mother would take care of it in the kitchen, and we would freeze it, and that's what we had for our fish, and it took me a long time. This is a good recipe.
I'm sorry we're out of time for our recipe.
All right. Lentils. Start out with 1 cup of dried. You know, there's political aspect to every recipe that we try.
Why don't you tell us another story or two before we actually get to
lentils. 1 cup of dried green lentils.
A cup of dried green lentils.
Now, you can use red lentils that are really kind of orange, but you can use red lentils.
Okay.
But 1 cup.
Yeah.
2 tablespoonfuls of unsalted butter.
2 big T unsalted butter.
1 cup finely chopped onion.
Cup of finely chopped onion.
Cup of finely chopped onion.
Yep.
3 cloves of garlic chopped.
3 cloves of chopped garlic.
That's right. If you love garlic like I do, throw more in.
Yeah.
1/2 teaspoon of salt.
Half a little tea salt.
4 tablespoonfuls of parsley.
4 big T parsley.
1 tablespoonful of fresh lemon juice.
A big T fresh lemon juice.
That's right. Now, if you don't have fresh lemon juice, you can use the frozen kind, as I said, that you keep in the refrigerator. It is a good substitute. But I don't use real lemon, which you buy on the shelf. I use that for lemonade in the summertime. But I wouldn't use it because it's really not as aromatic. Mm. 1/4 teaspoon of freshly ground black pepper.
1/4 little tea, black pepper.
Okay, now for the fish.
Mm-hmm.
4 6-ounce cod fillets.
4 6 ounce cod fillets.
Cod fillets or cod fillets, depending on your persuasion. Yeah. And once again, you can use any other white fish. Flounder will work. Orange roughy, tilapia would work too. Yeah. You can use some salt and pepper, by the way, to taste with that. Mm-hmm. A tablespoonful of unsalted butter.
One big tea unsalted
and
butter.
And lemon wedges to garnish. Or if you're feeling really good, you could use lime in there too to garnish.
Yeah. Either one, lemon or lime. Very good on fish.
Yeah, they're great. They're great. And by the way, when you shop for lemons or limes, squeeze them. Squeeze them. The ones I was at a bar recently talking to a guy about making a Cosmo, and he said, make sure they're juicy limes. And I've never really squeezed limes and lemons, and there really is a difference. So nice squeezy lemon, a nice squeezy lime. I know you're digressing again. Okay.
Oh, that's all right.
Place the lentils in a saucepan, cover with cold water, simmer until they're tender. That's about 25 or 30 minutes. Then reserve a half a cup of the cooking liquid and drain the lentils. Now melt butter in a heavy saucepan over medium heat. Stir in the onion, garlic, and salt and cook over that medium heat until it's translucent. And that's about 10 minutes. Then remove the cover and cook an additional 5 to 10 minutes until they're golden. So you're getting rid of the water that's in there. Then stir in the cooked lentils and the reserved cooking liquid and heat it through. And then prior to serving, you're going to add the parsley, lemon juice, and pepper. Now, in a separate pan, season the cod fillets with salt and pepper. Heat the butter in a nonstick skillet over medium heat. Saute the cod, turning once until it's just cooked through. That's about 3 to 4 minutes per side. Serve the fish, put the lentil sauce on top of it, and then garnish with the lemon wedge or lime wedge. And bon appetit. Mm-hmm. And it's a great recipe, but I want to talk about the analysis, which I think is really important. Okay, we've got 341 calories, so that makes it really a very low-caloric recipe. Our fat is only 16%, so we have hardly any fat. But get this, 46 grams of protein. This is 93%, so you've got roughly 100% of the protein that you need for your entire day from this recipe. Mm. So this is a high-protein, low-calorie, low-fat recipe. Mm. It's dynamite.
Yeah. Did you say you were drinking Cosmos at a bar?
That's a long story, and I'm not going to get into that. But if you want our recipe, you can come to our website at zorbapastor.org, or you can find us through Facebook. And by the way, when you come to our website, you can sign up for our weekly podcast, and you can search all of our favorite archive recipes. That's zorbapastor.org, and the Cosmo story will be continued at some later date.
That's a girly drink. One 800 462 7413 is our toll-free number. 800 462 7413. Here's a listener with us now, Zorba in St. Louis, Missouri. Hi.
Hello. Love the show.
Thank you. How can we help?
Well, I was calling because I'm 26 years old, and about 2.5 months ago, I started having a lot of pain after I would eat, and a lot of tests and things came and went. Come to find out that they needed to remove my gallbladder. It wasn't contracting properly. So they went ahead and took that out last week. And I was curious as to what your advice would be about what kind of dietary changes I'm going to have to make now that I no longer have that gallbladder anymore.
That's a young age to have your gallbladder removed. Did your mom have gallbladder disease or your dad?
My mom did. Hers was taken out at age 38.
At age 38. Because, usually if you have to have your gallbladder removed at that age, there's a genetic predisposition. So your mom had it at 38, which is, you've obviously had that gene in the family. Well, the gallbladder is kind of an interesting organ. It is a sac. It is a repository sac for bile. And bile is important as an emulsion to basically emulsify fat within the intestines. So basically an homogenizes fat, so it can be in tiny little bubbles, and so we can actually absorb the fat through our small intestines. So it's important for that. And what happens when your gallbladder is removed? Normally, you eat a high fat meal. You go out for fish and chips, and you eat a high fat meal. You have some fries, and the gallbladder contracts and says, "Hey, I've got oil in my intestine. I've got to emulsify that oil," and there's bile there. And what we've discovered is that you don't really need to have that sac, and you're just going to have a gentle flow of bile that goes into your intestines. So you don't really have to change your diet. Now, It's interesting that for some people, when they eat a high-fat diet, then after their gallbladder has been removed, they feel bloated. Not everybody, but some people. And that's probably because they don't have enough bile at that moment in their intestine for the sort of rush of food that comes through. But on the whole, you can eat a normal diet, but you may notice if you go out for, we'll say, you know, fish and chips, and you eat, you know, we'll say steak, fish and chips, or, well, who's going to do that? But anyway, if you go out for a high-fat meal, you may discover you're not going to feel that good.
But fish and chips during Lent, you know, that's a much more common thing. So I guess I'll have to.
You might have some baked fish instead. You take care and good luck to you.
Well, thank you.
We appreciate the call at 800-462-7413. A listener in Fremont, Ohio. Now, hello.
Hello.
What's up?
Well, I'm a tad red green colorblind. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say I'm unable to see colors, but it seems to be the case where I forget what they're called, I'll call something by the wrong color, and it's a running gag with my family and I. A couple of years ago, I got a prescription pair of glasses that were tinted orange. I was looking for some kind of sunglasses since I was kind of out of the market. I had to wear my prescription glasses all the time, and when I put on the orange prescription glasses, all of a sudden those little color circles with dots you read the number in, it denotes which type of colorblind you are. I could read the red green colorblind circles.
Oh, that's very interesting. Let me explain what that is to people who've never seen it. There's a book called, I think it's called Ishikara. It's got a Japanese name, and I'm sure I'll be corrected on our website, but it's called something like Ishikara. And this is a book of little dots, and it determines colorblindness, because if you can't differentiate red and green, you look at these dots and you read a number that's in them, or a letter, and if you can't differentiate it, you read the wrong number or the wrong letter.
The number is within a whole field of other dots,
and you read them incorrectly. So when you were using the orange tinted glasses, you were answering the questions correctly. Is that what happened?
Yes, for red green colorblind. But then I couldn't read the blue green colorblind circles.
Oh wow, that's very interesting. So when you you couldn't read the blue green colorblind, but you could read the red green colorblind. That's very interesting. What was it like to see? I mean, forget the book. What was it like for life when you were wearing these tinted glasses?
Everything was orange.
Shocking that everything was orange. Everything.
But it did change things, and it made me wonder. My optometrist said, "Wow, I've never seen anything like that." And I thought, I wish someone could do some research in this direction. Maybe a very light tint of a certain wavelength would enable people with mild colorblindness to see the correct colors that everyone else is seeing.
Well, that's very, very interesting. It's something that actually occurs in the cones. The cones are the things that differentiate the colors, and that's I've never seen any research on it, not as if I've ever been looking for research on that. Tinted glasses are not uncommon. They're not a common thing, but they're certainly not rare, because you can buy a slight tint, and I know that I think they're grade 1 through 5 for the amount of tint. I want to get back to, so did you buy these glasses and wear them? You wore them? And
I did.
Yeah.
I did. They were actually, I immediately the day after lost my clear glasses, so I had those for about 2 years.
So when you finally got a new set of glasses, did you get clear or tint?
Well, I went to a transition, so I try to get the best of both worlds as far as clear or tint. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The gray tint on the transitions doesn't change the color scheme at all for me.
Well, what you bring up is very, very interesting, because you've changed the wavelength that's going into your eye, and that obviously changed, you know, how you were responding to the red and green. I'll do some research on this, and if we have something, I'll post it on our website and our Facebook page. At this moment, I have not the foggiest idea why it worked, and obviously your optometrist felt the same way.
Sometime you and Zorba have to get together with your tinted glasses and have a Cosmo.
I hope so. They're delightful.
Hey, the Cosmo's great. It's not just a girly drink. We've got to be a little PC here. Men can have Cosmos. Women can put down a shot of Jack.
And anybody can have orange-tinted glasses. Thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Well, Zorba, before we head out for a short break, it's time for another edition of your favorite segment, Disagreeing with the Doc. Not too long ago, we were helping a listener out with an energy drink question. Your answer didn't sit too well with one of our listeners named Justin. He writes, "You solved a dispute between a man and a wife regarding the drink 5-Hour Energy. You said that the man was tired in the evening because of his frequent consumption of 5-Hour Energy in the afternoon. You specifically made a comment about over-caffeination. Well, 5-Hour Energy doesn't contain any caffeine, nor any caffeine-containing products. It's very small, about a swallow, and it's mostly B vitamins. P.S., it tastes horrible."
Well, if we look at all the energy drinks together, 95% of those that are consumed contain caffeine. If 5-Hour Energy drink doesn't contain caffeine, then I stand corrected. But the reality is you've got to read that label. And if you read the label, and if the label says caffeine on it, then it has caffeine. And frankly, I will have to disagree with this particular email, because when I looked at 5-Hour Energy Drink, at least the original formula, which was back probably a few months ago, it said that it contained caffeine. So my recommendation is this. Read the label. If the label has caffeine, then it's part of the caffeine you drink, you get in your diet, which I'm not against. Or the website that I've been really like, nutritional website that I think is really, really good, is livestrong.com. And we'll put a link to that on our website and Facebook page, and look at that and see what they say about 5-Hour Energy drinks or any of the other energy drinks that you happen to like.
If some of Zorba's advice is draining your energy, let us know for the next edition of Disagreeing with the Doc. Just send your rebuttal to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Stick around. We have some interesting research to talk about. More of your calls, of course, at our Medical Mythbuster 2 here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our toll-free number again is 800-462-7413. But now, Zorba, before our next call, let's spend some time talking about radiation.
Right, right. As you know, there's lots of stuff going on in Japan right now with nuclear reactors. The final word on how much radiation is actually in the air, how much has actually been released, is going to take a while for us to completely evaluate.
Sure.
It. And, there are going to be mixed messages. We're going to know after the event how much is actually there. And generally, the more radiation that's emitted, obviously, the greater the danger and the risk is there, and it decreases.
They're widening the zone where they're taking people out of there around these reactors as we speak.
Absolutely. And I think it's because we're dealing with something that we don't see very often. And it's, at this particular moment, when we look at it, it's not in the scale of the Chernobyl amount of radiation that's being released. But time is going to tell exactly how much is there.
Yeah.
But the real issue is, what do you do in situations like this? I mean, we have nuclear reactors, and of course, we have assurance that we're not going to have the problems that they have under their situation. But of course, what does that assurance mean? We haven't had an earthquake.
They were
assured
they were going to have those problems before the problems
Absolutely. And of course, it was a big earthquake. And so there are a couple of things that actually are very, very important. You can breathe in the particles that can cause a problem, and that's why sometimes the advice is to, stay in the house and seal the house. Well, how well can you actually seal the house? Mm-hmm. But there are other issues that have to actually do with the fact that you can have radiation, on the clothing that you're wearing. So the simple removal of clothing, putting on fresh clothes can remove up to 80 to 90% of the external radiation particles that are in the air. Washing with soap and water can actually remove it from the skin, lowers your risk of actually breathing these particles in. But there are other issues in that when uranium is actually making, the energy that is actually going on in a nuclear plant, the byproduct happens to be radioactive iodine. And by taking large amounts of iodine tablets, which is what the Japanese government is actually giving people around the area, you will saturate your thyroid with iodine so you don't begin to incorporate it, the radioactive iodine, which can cause a number of the problems. You know, the other problem with this is fear. You know, frankly. And that's going to produce a lot of post-traumatic stress disorder among the Japanese.
Shortly after Three Mile Island, my wife and I were on the train going from Chicago to Philadelphia and went right by Three Mile Island.
Oh, wow.
And it was just – there was just a feeling that you had going by that place.
Right, right. Feeling. And it's the same
no
thing
danger.
With people are going – no danger. It's going to be when people go to, you know, go to Japan. You have that. So I think you have the physical aspects of radiation and then the psychological aspects that go along with any event such as this.
800-462-7413, toll free to St. Louis now. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my question.
Yeah, we appreciate it. How can we help?
Well, I'm currently pregnant, and I had a question. I saw some research that eating dark chocolate can help prevent preeclampsia. So I was really interested in whether or not you'd heard of that and how much chocolate I would have to eat.
I've got it. So you are pregnant, I take that.
Yes, she said.
Yes, yes.
Preeclampsia, what's that sort of?
Well, preeclampsia is a syndrome that has to do with hypertension in pregnancy, high blood pressure in pregnancy. That's one of your children in the background, right?
That would be my firstborn. Yes.
Your firstborn. Did you have preeclampsia with your first child?
I did.
You did. And it's more common in first pregnancies. It's a syndrome of high blood pressure. There's spilling of a protein in the urine. It can be associated with seizures. It can be a devastating problem. It can actually even cause death. Not common as commonly as it used to, by no means, but it's a very serious issue. Did you have seizures or just high blood pressure? What did you have in your first pregnancy?
Well, I had mild preeclampsia, so it never developed to preeclampsia. I just had high blood pressure and the urine, protein in my urine. So I just kind of monitored at home and had modified bed rest.
Right, right. And those are, you know, and that is the particular treatment. I have read about this dark chocolate association with it. And there's no scientific study. It was sort of, from what I remember, it was an observation study that women who had a piece of dark chocolate every day appeared not to have as much preeclampsia. Now, there's nothing wrong with having a piece of dark chocolate.
Right.
It's good. It's healthy. It makes you feel good. You know, what's a piece? I don't think the study was that particular about it. There are a couple of interesting things about preeclampsia. It's much more common in first pregnancies. It's less common in the second pregnancy, but it's still, if you've had it in the first pregnancy, you know, it still puts you at a higher risk in that second pregnancy to get it. And monitoring your blood pressure closely, which I'm sure you're doing with your doctor, I mean, that's what I'm assuming, you know, is the important thing. So if I would give advice on how much to have, I would have basically the equivalent of a piece of chocolate from a really good chocolate place every day. That's what I would have.
A piece.
I mean,
not 2 bars of dark chocolate.
I would not have 2 bars of dark chocolate. And because I happen to have a local chocolatier that I love, that's where I would have my dark chocolate. But I'm sure commercial grade. Well, yeah. Let's go into the chocolate. What kind of chocolate do you like?
Well, you know, hey, any kind of chocolate works for me.
Bingo.
So I would have what I would probably have is about 100. But, you know, if you were going to have it, I would probably have 100 to 200 calories of dark chocolate. That's what I would have looking at that. So that would be probably, you know, half a chocolate bar to a whole chocolate bar. And what I would do is I would choose one that was 85% or higher dark chocolate and cocoa, or I would go to a local chocolatier. I would not have milk chocolate, because if I were going to have it, I would have it would have to say dark chocolate, and it would have to be greater than 85%. That's kind of how it's labeled.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Take care, and hope you have a good delivery.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, Zorba, time once again now for our medical myth buster. We have a listener myth today from a friend of the show, Mika in Knoxville, Tennessee. He writes, "Dear Zorba, I think I remember hearing you parrot the party line that dark meat is significantly fattier than white meat in poultry and is to be preferred. A recent NPR story says otherwise. So, Zorba, is it a myth that white meat is healthier for you?
Well, first of all, dark meat has more fat. That's always the way it is. Dark meat is tastier for most of us because it has more fat. And if you put it on the barbecue, it doesn't dry out as much because it has more fat. And so there's no doubt that dark meat has more fat, significantly meaning it always has a little bit more fat. Now, we have become sort of a white meat society. So white meat is PC. Dark meat is not as PC. Why? Because we generally have too much fat in our diet. But I myself prefer dark meat. And if you look at a lot of cultures, especially in Asia, dark meat is preferred because it pulls in the spices, it pulls in the marinade really more than white meat. And I don't think I would say that dark meat is bad for you. But on the whole, dark meat in our society is not as preferred because it has more fat. And the nutritionists are often saying, well, get rid of fat in your diet, so you should have, you know, boneless, skinless chicken breast.
Well, you always say eat white meat.
Yeah, and generally, I think from a health point of view, white meat is healthier. But on the other hand, a good chicken leg tastes really, really good on the barbecue. And, you know, an occasional wing is really, really good. So I still think white meat is preferable because it's a high-protein source with no fat. And dark meat is wonderful for that tasty treat that you want to have on that occasional basis.
Have a myth you'd like to see busted in white or dark? Send your medical myth to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
The number is 800-462-7413. And our next caller, Zorba, is in Seymour, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hey there.
What's up?
Well, I don't know if you guys have heard much about this phenomenon. You ever hear of breaking the seal?
Breaking the seal.
Yeah, it's a drinking concept. When you drink, it's right after you start drinking, and then you have to go to the bathroom. But you hold on to it. The longer you hold on to it, it keeps you from having to pee again.
Oh, I get it. So the longer, if you hold it for a long time, then you don't have to go as often. You say.
Yeah, and I wasn't sure if going that first time makes a difference, or if it's just because you just continue to drink.
Well, let's talk a little bit about it. First of all, there's the younger bladder and older bladder. So if you have the older bladder, you probably don't have a choice of whether or not you have to break the seal or not. There really isn't a seal there at all. But what happens is when your bladder gets to a certain size and it expands, you know, it sends immediately an impulse to your brain, hey, I've got to pee. I've got to go and pee. And what happens is we can avoid that impulse. And we do that all the time. You know, there's not a bathroom around. You know, we're at a party or we're at a parade and we're outside and we have to urinate and we choose to avoid that particular sensation. And we do that over time. There's no actually seal that's there. We choose to avoid it. And what happens is then we can get to a point where we really have to urinate. And then, of course, we have to go and we have to empty our bladder. But it's a myth that there's actually a seal there. It's that once you go and you urinate and you've done it, you probably just go, hey, man, I can just go and urinate whenever I want to. And then it just, you know, then you'll go and you'll pay attention to that stimulation and you'll do it a second time. But there's no seal involved. There's no... there's no spasm that's actually there, and once you break the seal, you have to go over and over again. That itself is a myth, and what's happening is once you've actually urinated, you're paying attention to what's going on, and then you decide you're going to urinate
again. So it's all in the mind.
It's all in the mind.
It's all in
the habit. You got it, baby. It's all in the mind. It's all in the habit. So if you want to drink a lot and not go to the bathroom, that just becomes a habit point of view.
So I don't want to get up because I'm watching the show, and I'm just going to have to pinch it off then.
No, that's exactly it. You got it. That's exactly it. And then once you get up and you go and you realize you're actually more comfortable with an empty bladder, you tend to do it again earlier. That's what happens.
Wow.
It's a comfort issue. That's what happens.
Sounds like it could lead to an addiction.
Well, thanks for listening to the show.
All right.
I appreciate
it. Thanks for taking my
call. Yeah, we appreciate your calling. Before we get out of here for the week, Zorba, you may want to dry clean your black robe because it's time once again for Judge Zorba. That was supposed to sound like a gavel.
No, I thought it was that. Just, you know what? It was a radio gavel. It sounded really good. It
sounded like me slapping my hand.
Well, you know, because we don't always have a gavel with us.
Anyway, today's case comes to us from a listener named Richard and deals with one of your favorite topics, coffee. Do you want to recuse yourself now, Zorba?
Not at all.
Oh, okay. Not Richard writes, I'm experiencing an ongoing discussion concerning the consumption of reheated coffee via microwave. I have this argument with my friend Mary every time I reheat a cup of coffee that has sat overnight. My friend says that she's always been told that this practice causes hardening of the arteries. I say this is totally bunko. What do you say?
Well, I must tell you that Mary's information that reheating coffee causes hardening of the arteries is incorrect. You are correct. It is bunko. There is no evidence that coffee causes hardening of the arteries and no evidence at all that reheating coffee would cause hardening of the arteries, except reheated coffee doesn't taste very good.
No kidding. There's plenty of evidence that reheated
coffee. It doesn't taste very good, and that's one aspect, but it certainly does not cause hardening of the arteries.
Well, if you have a case for Judge Zorba that's gone cold and you need to reheat it, just add it to the docket by sending your affidavit or email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We'll see you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our recipe podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org or find us on Facebook.
Don't forget, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's produced by Adam Cod Friedrich and Brad Lentils Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll join us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.